I have this question that's been kind of bothering me since I started reading through the notes for this deep dive.
Oh, yeah. What is it?
Well, it sounds simple, right?
I.
But if you actually try to answer it, it's surprisingly slippery. The question is truth a noun or is it a verb?
Oh, wow. See, that's the kind of question that usually gets you kicked out of a dinner party.
I know.
But it's actually the perfect way to frame what we're talking about today.
Right, because intuitively, I want to say truth is a noun. Like, it's a gold bar sitting in a vault somewhere. It's static. It's eternal. It's totally separate from me. And my job as a human is just to go find it.
That is the classic view. Yeah.
But the source material we are covering today, which is a really fascinating lecture by Dr. Arthur Holmes on the history of philosophy, it suggests that truth isn't something you find. It's something you actually do.
It's a massive pivot.
Okay.
And for everyone listening, what we are really unpacking here is the transition from that old world European philosophy, which was very rigid, mathematical, mechanical, into what we call American pragmatism.
Right, and the big players here are names you might vaguely remember from, like a high school civics class or history class, Charles Sanders Peirce, William James, and John Dewey.
Yeah, the heavy hitters.
And what really strikes me about Dr. Holmes's breakdown is this isn't just abstract theory for guys sitting around in tweed jackets. This is the philosophy of, getting your hands dirty.
Oh, absolutely.
It changes how you view literally everything. From education to watching a football game to how you decide if you should believe in God or not.
It really does change the whole framework. It's the move from viewing the universe as a machine to viewing it as an organism. And that shift that changes the rules for everything.
So let's start right there. The old view. Holmes calls this the mechanistic model of the 18th century. I think we need to set the scene so we understand what these American thinkers were actually rebelling against.
Sure. So picture a giant clock, or actually, better yet, picture a pool table.
Okay, a pool table, I'm with you.
In the mechanistic model, reality is made up of substances. These are hard, static things. In physics, this is the Newtonian world. You have billiard balls.
Okay, so metaphorically, in this old world view, I'm a billiard ball. You're a billiard ball. We are distinct, solid objects.
Right. And if we interact, say, I crash into you during a debate or an argument, that is what philosophers call an external relation.
External relation, meaning what exactly?
Meaning we just bounce off each other. Maybe we change direction or we change speed. But the interaction doesn't change what we fundamentally are. We remain separate, unchanging entities.
So relationships in that model are just kind of like geography. We're bumping into each other,
Yeah.
but we aren't actually connected in any deep, meaningful way.
That is the exact 18th century view. It's very lonely if you really think about it. It's a universe of strangers.
Yeah, that sounds incredibly isolated.
But then the 19th century hits, and science completely disrupts this. You get Darwin and evolution showing that species aren't static. You get biology showing how organisms actually grow and change.
And later Einstein, right?
Yeah.
Showing that even time and space aren't rigid.
Exactly. And suddenly, that solid, static billiard ball universe looks, well, it looks insufficient. It doesn't match the science anymore.
The stuff isn't solid anymore. It's fluid.
It's not even stuff at all. And this is where Alfred North Whitehead comes in. He's the crucial bridge to the Americans.
Yeah.
He argues that the fundamental unit of reality isn't a thing, it's an event or a process.
An event. Okay, Holmes uses a great analogy here to explain the difference between a thing and an event. And it's one I think almost everyone listening has either lived through or can imagine
Yeah.
going to college for the first time.
It's the perfect example to illustrate this shift. Because if you view a student as a billiard ball, they just roll onto campus, sit in a class, get a degree, and roll off campus.
They haven't fundamentally changed their nature.
Right. They just added an accessory,
Yeah.
piece of paper. But Whitehead says, no, going to college is an event, and an event has a very specific dynamic structure.
Let's break that structure down because this is where the organism idea really clicked for me.
So, according to Whitehead, every event has three stages. First, you have the past.
Which means you don't just appear out of a vacuum.
Exactly. You bring your history, your awkward high school years, your specific anxieties, your parents' expectations. That's the raw material you show up with.
I definitely arrived on campus with some baggage, so I get that. That's stage one. What's stage two?
Stage two is the objective data. This is the environment itself, the campus buildings, the syllabus, the professors who honestly do not care about your personal baggage.
Right, the hard reality you collide with.
Yes. But here is the kicker. The third part is the subjective aim.
the subjective aim. That sounds like the decision-making part of the process.
It is. An event isn't just something happening to you passively. You are active in it. You have a goal. You say to yourself, I'm going to get an education. Or I'm going to reinvent my personality.
Or maybe just, I am going to survive until Friday.
Fair enough. But that subjective aim, that goal, dictates how the event unfolds. It filters all that objective data.
And this leads to that concept of internal relations, which Holmes talks about.
Yeah.
I think this is the hardest part of this whole philosophy to grasp, but it's probably the most important.
It is the core of it, yeah.
In the billiard ball model, the relationship is external. But here?
Here, the relationship is internal. This means the relationship actually constitutes who you are. The experience of college literally constructs your identity.
So I'm not a ball bouncing off a university wall.
No, you are a process that is being shaped by the university, and you are actively shaping it back. When you leave, you are physically and mentally a completely different organism than when you arrived.
That really blurs the line between the observer and the observed, doesn't it? I'm not just watching the movie of my life from a theater seat. I'm directing it and starring in it simultaneously.
Completely. You are in the flow of it. And that is the exact bridge to American pragmatism. Once you realize that we aren't just watching the universe, that we are participating in it, you open the door for John Dewey and his crew.
So let's walk through that door to Dewey. Holmes outlines three main pillars of pragmatism. And the first one feels like a direct head-on attack on those ivory tower philosophers who just sit around thinking all day. He calls it the primacy of the practical.
This is practically the headline for the whole movement. Theory is secondary. Practice comes first. The pragmatists were absolutely sick of what Dewey called spectator empiricism.
Yeah, spectator empiricism. That sounds like a very sophisticated insult.
Oh, it's definitely intended as one. He was criticizing John Locke and the older British empiricists. Locke famously thought the mind was a blank slate, right? Just a passive receptor of data.
Yeah.
Dewey said, that's like watching a football game. Yeah. You have 22 players on the field effectively killing themselves, acting, deciding, moving. And then you have 40,000 people up in the stands just sitting there.
And Locke thinks the philosopher is the guy up in the stands.
Exactly. Just recording stats. Player four moved left. The ball is brown. The grass is green. Dewey says, no, philosophy isn't watching the game. Philosophy isn't playing the game.
Because experience isn't something you just look at.
Right. It's something you do. It's dangerous. It's active. You risk interception. You get hit.
So get a helmet. Don't just analyze life. Actually engage with it. I love that. So that's pillar one. What is pillar two?
Pillar two is organic relationships. And this ties right back to Whitehead. The pragmatists absolutely hated atomism.
Atomism being the idea that you can chop reality up into little isolated bits, like Lego bricks.
Great analogy, yes. Locke and the old guard thought ideas were like little bricks you just click together. Here is a brick of red. Here is a brick of round. Now I have a red ball in my mind.
And William James disagreed with that.
He thought it was absolute nonsense. James said consciousness isn't a bucket of Legos. It's a stream. It flows. You can't chop it up into distinct pieces without killing it.
So everything is connected to everything else. My idea of dinner isn't separate from my idea of hunger or my memories of cooking.
Precisely. It all bleeds together, and ideas aren't just snapshots of the past. This is the key insight for James and Dewey. An idea is actually a tool for the future.
A tool for the future. How so?
You don't have an idea just to have it, like a trophy on a shelf. You have an idea to prepare for what's coming next. An idea is a plan of action.
Which sets up pillar three perfectly. Philosophical naturalism.
Right. This is the method. If we are active participants in a natural world, if we are the players on the field, then we need a strategy. We should use the best tool we have to understand the game.
And for the pragmatists, that tool is the scientific method.
Yes. But they didn't just mean for chemistry or physics. They weren't just talking about lab work with test tubes.
No, and that's the really radical part. They wanted to apply the scientific method to literally everything. Ethics, logic, politics, even how we form our deeply personal beliefs.
Dewey, specifically, was a metaphysical naturalist. He believed nature is all there is. There is no supernatural realm. There's no heaven of abstract perfect forms where truth with a capital T lives.
So even our thoughts, our philosophies, they are just biological adaptations.
Yes. Just like a bird evolved a wing to fly, humans evolved thinking to solve problems. Ideas evolve. The bad ones, the ones that don't work in reality, they die out. The good ones survive.
Okay, so if ideas are tools for survival, we need to know how to maintain them. We need to know which tools are sharp and which are dull. And I think this brings us to the heavy hitter of the group, the working scientist, Charles Sanders Peirce.
Peirce, pronounced purse, by the way. He is essentially the grumpy grandfather of pragmatism.
Grumpy? Why grumpy?
Well, he was a working scientist for the U.S. Coastal Survey. He dealt with hard measurements and weights, and he actually got so annoyed with how loosey-goosey William James was getting with these ideas later on that he renamed his own philosophy pragmatism.
Wait, he literally changed the brand name of his own philosophy because he didn't want to be associated with the others.
Yes, he famously said a name so ugly no one would want to steal it. He thought pragmatism was being kidnapped to mean whatever makes you happy is true. And Peirce was a strict realist. He believed there is a real hard world out there, regardless of what you think about it.
And he wrote this brilliant essay called The Fixation of Belief, right? Let's dive into that. Fixation here meaning, how do we make a belief stick? How do we settle our minds so we can stop worrying?
Correct. Peirce says we all hate the irritation of doubt. Doubt is uncomfortable. It paralyzes us. We want to feel settled. So he outlines four methods that humans use to fix our beliefs.
Okay, four methods. Let's go through them. What's the first one?
The first is tenacity.
Tenacity. I call this the ostrich method.
Pretty much. It's just stubbornness. You blindly hold on to a belief and absolutely refuse to look at anything that contradicts it. You just say, I don't care what the deity says. I am right.
Does it work? Because I feel like I know a lot of people who use this method very successfully today.
It works briefly. It brings you peace of mind for a little bit. But Peirce says the social impulse eventually destroys it.
Because we aren't completely isolated.
Right. You can't live in a bubble forever. Eventually, you notice other people disagree with you. You see that your neighbor, who is smart and successful, thinks totally differently about the world. And that crack in the armor lets the doubt creep back in.
So when tenacity fails, you move to method two, authority.
Yes. This is the method of the state or the church or maybe just your strict political party. You let an institution dictate the truth for you.
It takes the pressure off the individual.
Exactly. And it's very effective for creating social stability. If everyone agrees because the king says so, you have peace in the kingdom. But it has the same fatal flaw. Eventually, you meet a different authority.
Right. If the church says X and state says Y, or if you travel to a totally different country with different rules, the whole system crumbles.
Exactly. So yeah. Then there's the third method, which I think most people today actually use without even realizing it, the a priori method, or the method of taste.
Taste, like intellectual taste.
Inclination might be the best word for it. It's believing what just feels rational or agreeable to you. It's not based on hard facts. It's based on your intuition. You say, well, it just makes sense to me that the universe works this way.
It's the my truth era.
Exactly. But as Peirce points out, what makes sense to you depends entirely on your culture, your era, and your upbringing. It's subjective fashion. It's not truth. What made perfect sense to a 15th century monk does not make sense to you today.
Okay, so tenacity fails because we're social creatures. Authority fails because different authorities clash. Taste fails because it's totally subjective.
Yeah.
That leaves the winner.
The method of science. And Peirce loves this method for one specific defining reason. It is public.
Meaning it's not just inside my head.
Right. It appeals to an external reality that affects everyone equally. Gravity pulls on you the exact same way it pulls on me, regardless of what we believe about it.
And it's open to scrutiny.
And most importantly, science is self-correcting. If you use the method of authority and the authority is wrong, you're stuck. You can't question the king. But if you use science, the method itself is explicitly designed to find errors. It wants to be proven wrong so it can get closer to the truth.
Now, Peirce uses this whole framework to launch a massive attack on René Descartes. And this really surprised me when reading the notes, because Descartes is usually held up as the untouchable father of modern philosophy. I think, therefore, I am. But Peirce just tears him apart.
He really does. He attacks the very foundation of how Descartes tried to find truth. Remember, Descartes' whole thing was universal doubt. He went into a stove-heated room, basically a 17th century sauna, and tried to doubt absolutely everything until he found one single thing he couldn't doubt.
He tried to wipe his mind completely blank. And Peirce says that's fake.
He calls it a total sham. Peirce says you can't just decide to doubt everything. We are full of biases and beliefs we aren't even consciously aware of.
You can't just flip a switch and turn off your human nature.
Right. You can't wipe the slate clean. We always start in media res. We start in the middle of things. Peirce says you can't fake complete doubt any more than you can fake being surprised. True doubt has to be forced on you by an actual experience.
I love the metaphor Peirce uses here to explain the difference in their two approaches. He compares Descartes' philosophy to a chain. and his own scientific approach to a cable.
It's a brilliant image, and it really clarifies why the scientific method is so powerful. Descartes tries to build a single chain of logic. Argument A leads to argument B, which leads to argument C.
It looks very elegant on paper.
It looks perfect, but what happens if just one link snaps? What if argument A is even slightly wrong?
The whole thing falls apart, the chain breaks, and you lose everything.
Exactly. It's incredibly fragile. Pierce says philosophy shouldn't be a single fragile chain. It should be like a heavy industrial cable.
Made of lots of different strands.
Yeah.
Yes. It's made of many thin wire fibers. Maybe you have a bit of logic, a bit of observation, some historical data, some physics. Each individual fiber might be pretty weak on its own. You could snap one easily. But if you weave them all together,
the cable becomes practically unbreakable.
That's the strength of science. It's relying on the weight of converging evidence, not the perfection of one single solitary logical argument. We don't believe in evolution because of one perfect sentence Charles Darwin wrote in a book.
Right.
We believe it because geology, genetics, biology, and chemistry all weave together to form a cable that supports it.
Okay, so Pierce gives us this rigorous, heavy-duty cable of scientific truth. He's the stern realist of the group. But then we have William James. And James seems to soften things up quite a bit. He comes from a totally different background.
He does. He was a psychologist first. He was actually one of the founders of modern psychology in America. And that fundamentally changes his focus. Pierce is looking out at the external world. The weights, the measures, the hard facts. James is looking at the internal experience. He's deeply interested in the feeling of believing something.
And this brings us to the concept that everyone quotes, and from what I understand, almost everyone misunderstands, the cash value of truth.
It's a phrase that got him in a lot of hot water. People heard cash value and thought he meant truth is just about making money or being successful in business, a very cynical reading.
But that's not what he meant.
Not at all. He meant experiential payoff, practical consequences.
How does that actually work in practice? How do we use that to find truth?
James argues that we spend way too much time arguing about abstract definitions that don't matter. He says we should ask one simple question. What is the practical difference in my life if I believe X instead of Y? If there is no practical difference in how I act or how I feel, then the dispute is completely meaningless.
He uses a really heavy example for this. The debate between materialism and spiritualism or theism. Basically, the God versus no God debate.
Yes, and notice how he approaches it. He says we shouldn't look at the logical abstract proofs for God. We should look at the psychological consequences of the beliefs.
Because you can't really prove it either way scientifically.
Exactly. You can't prove God exists with a telescope, and you can't disprove him either. So James says, look at the cash value. Let's start with materialism. What is the payoff there?
Well, if materialism is true, the universe is just atoms and void. Eventually, the sun burns out, the earth freezes, humanity dies off, and literally nothing we ever did matters. It's a very cold, indifferent universe.
Right. And James points out that the psychological result of that belief is a denial of the moral order. It cuts off ultimate hope. It feels incredibly heavy. Now, it might be factually true, but the payoff for human life is bleak. So then he asks, what is the cash value of theism?
Theism promises that there is an internal moral order. That things actually do matter in the end. That justice is real, even if we don't see it now.
It lets loose hope, that's his phrase. It provides what James calls a moral holiday. A feeling that you can relax just a little bit, because the universe is ultimately safe and meaningful.
So James is saying that because theism makes me feel hopeful and allows me to act with confidence and moral courage in the world, it is true.
He's saying that if the belief works, if it helps you navigate your human life satisfactorily and leads to positive action, then it has truth value. Truth isn't just about perfectly copying objective reality. It's about workability.
I have to push back on that, though. I mean, playing devil's advocate here, that sounds incredibly dangerous. If I believe I can fly, that might give me a truly great feeling of hope and exhilaration right up until I jump off the roof of a building.
And that is exactly where Pierce would jump in and scream at James. There is a huge fundamental tension here between these two men.
I can see why Pierce wanted to change the name of his philosophy.
Exactly. James is so intensely focused on the psychological reality. If a belief cures your depression or gives you the courage to help your neighbor, it's true for you in that moment because it works. Pierce is focused on the external reality. Gravity does not care about your depression.
But for James, to be fair, he's really trying to solve those massive metaphysical arguments that never end. He's not talking about jumping off buildings and defying physics. He's talking about things we actually can't prove scientifically.
Yes, that's a very important distinction. He's saying, stop arguing over the dictionary definition of substance or essence. Look at the fruit, not the root. If a belief produces good fruits in a person's life, charity, courage, resilience, then we should deeply respect it. It has immense value.
It's a very uniquely American idea, isn't it? It's democratic. It's highly practical. It judges ideas by their results in the real world rather than their historical pedigree.
It really is. It takes philosophy out of the dusty lecture hall and puts it directly into the marketplace of life. It asks the ultimate practical question, what can this idea do for me today?
So let's try to tie this all together for you, the listener, because we've covered a massive amount of ground here. We started back in the 18th century. The universe is a clockwork machine. We are isolated billiard balls bouncing around. We are passive spectators watching the world happen from the stands.
And then Whitehead and the pragmatists wake us up. They tell us the universe is an organism. It's growing. It's a living process. And we aren't spectators in the stands at all. We are players down on the field.
And because we are players on the field, our beliefs actually matter. They aren't just thoughts in our heads. They are tools we use to build the future. Pierce tells us we have to test those tools with extreme scientific rigor so we don't get fooled by our own stubbornness or by authorities.
Right. He provides the anchor. And then James adds the human element back in. He tells us to check if those tools are actually working for us psychologically. Do they provide the hope and the vital energy we need to actually live good lives?
It really changes how you audit your own life. Instead of just asking, is this belief I hold abstractly true in some textbook? You have to ask, what is this belief doing for me? What is its cash value in my daily life?
It empowers you to take responsibility for your entire worldview. You are co-creating reality with every single choice you make. You aren't just passively finding truth. You are making it real through your actions.
But I do want to leave everyone listening with a final thought to mull over, because it kind of gnaws at me after going through all this. If we go with William James and we say truth is ultimately what works, what happens when a lie works better than the truth?
That is the dark side of pragmatism, isn't it?
Think about it. If believing a comforting lie gives me more satisfaction, more hope, and more cash value than a really harsh, depressing truth, is the lie better?
It's the ultimate dilemma. Is it better to be happy and wrong or miserable and right?
Pierce would say, get back to reality no matter how much it hurts. James might say, well, if it gets you through the night, it makes you a better person.
And that profound tension between what is objectively real and what practically works is something we still haven't entirely figured out. It's the core of the human condition.
Definitely something for all of you to chew on today as you look at your own beliefs. Thanks for diving deep with us.
Always a pleasure.